And we are back. Thank you guys so much for joining us. And got a special guest with us. And I've been wanting to talk to this guy for several months now. Because we're going to start this interview a little bit differently than we've ever started any other interview. We're going to start with it with me eating a big plate of crow and apologizing because I disagreed with him a few months back.
Wow.
And it cost us dearly. Let me introduce Tony Greer of TG Macro, frequent host on Real Vision, and one of the only sources that we pay for research for. So I think that speaks, in my opinion, as a money manager, I think that speaks the best. But anyway, Tony, thank you so much for being with us, and it's great to have you here on the show, man.
I'm honored to be here, Zach. Thanks for having me, man. How you doing?
Hey, not too bad, pal. So like I said, we got to start off with an apology, Tone. You and I had a tense back and forth on Twitter right around the bottom, right around March 23rd, and you were telling me to get bullish and that this thing was going to rip higher. I disagreed with you and basically told you were out of your mind. And here we are in... with the NASDAQ about, 20% above its previous all-time high in February, S&P breathing on all-time highs. First of all, hell of a call. Second of all, Tone, one of the things I wanted to do here, man, was walk through your thought process. Before we get into, what's going on currently, one of the things I have learned from you and a couple other guys is, it's great to be an investor. It's great to have a rigorous process and be a disciplined investor, but you also have to understand the trading aspect. Can you walk our listeners through why you – and Tony, again, tip of the cap, you were pounding the table, screaming for people to buy stocks. Why were you so confident, and walk us through what you saw and kind of let us in on that trading side of things that made you so, so persistent. You saw what you saw,
sure.
You knew it, you pulled the trigger. Walk us through that, would you?
Yeah, Zach, I'll tell you, I would love, there's a lot to unpack in looking back on that. And I just want to get a reference point. When exactly, just so that I can go through this and know from a position what I was thinking back then. What was the exact date that we spoke? Do you have it?
Oh, man, I don't. It was via Twitter. It was right by the bottom. I mean, maybe a couple days after.
Okay, so that's what you're referring to. So I can get into that. Yeah. All right, so the reason that I was able to get bullish, I suppose, if you want to talk about that, down towards the bottom of the lockdown puke at the end of, I guess it was March or middle of March or so, was that I guess in following markets, I've always paid close attention to there's one standout dynamic that I've watched for a long time called the tick index. And that the tick index is a really useful tool during sell-offs, and it has been for me during the entire bull market since 2008. And I'll tell you how the tick index works. It's basically it represents the New York Stock Exchange stocks that are trading on an uptick minus the number trading on a downtick. So to go into what that means, the tick index is a very different barometer of measuring how the market trades. So when basically you're in a scenario where all the bids are getting hit, you rack up these big negative extremes in the tick index. And when you are trading in a period where everybody's taking offers, obviously on the other side, you ring up a big positive extreme tick index print. So to get to the pulp of the matter, we used to see, one and two extreme tick index prints on the downside, and then the market would recover. And then we went into the season of February, March, that was the lockdown bludgeoning of the stock market, where we had massive tick index prints day in and day out. So it was this unbelievable sort of, bid hitting beast that reared its head in that most extreme sell off that we markets have ever seen. So when you start counting up these extreme tick index prints that are literally bludgeoning the market, You get to a point where you've seen so many in a row and the stocks are so washed out and some of them have gotten to really interesting support levels that you know at some point that the Federal Reserve is going to show up, right? Because their job is to keep this thing under control. And, you know, there's always a black swan that creeps up on it and takes the control away from them. But then invariably, you wind up seeing central banks back in control again, and you see volatility shrink back, and the stocks turn around. So what I had the combination of, luckily, was, you know, watching, observing all those massive tick index prints that are the magnitude of, say, greater than negative 1500 on the downside. When you get a print on an extreme that wide, that's usually on a big down day. It's usually on a day that market carves a new low for the move, you know, and people are sort of indiscriminately hitting bids to de-risk. Or potentially they happen when there's a blow up on the tape and somebody is just liquidating without being price sensitive. So we went through this period of about a month and a half where, you know, where we used to get two tick index prints and then a relief rally, where we were getting three index prints 1 week, three extreme tick index prints 1 week, and then three extreme prints the next week. And clearly this was not over. So as long as I could get used to the fact that the market was going to come off hard, I just had to get to the point where sentiment was absolutely bottomed out. And I will say that on that weekend when we were shutting things down finally, the way that I was able to get ahead of it was that I had postured correctly during the sell-off and said that we're going to reach an extreme low in the sell-off in sentiment when we actually close down the economy. And I think that the timing was pretty on there where, you know, we actually closed everything down toward the end of March. And that was actually the bottom of the move. And at the bottom of the move, Zach, I had people, you know, of all levels of wealth management and trading and professional trading saying, you know what, I think I got to buy puts on the S&P down here. You know, I mean, like this is naturally just going to, you know, it has to be a much smaller item if earnings are going to get bludgeoned for the next 2 or 3 years due to this lockdown recession. And so then once you knew that everybody after a move, in a 1,200 point move in the S&P, the fastest one that ever happened in history with the most extreme tick prints that I ever saw, all of a sudden, we got to a level where everybody that I talked to thought that the right move was to be short, looking for 1,500. And I said, well, these, you know, the number of interested sellers down here has certainly become extreme. And so it's time for me to start, you know, kind of grabbing your cojones and sticking some bids in where stocks are getting hit. And so once I saw that I was getting hit on stocks and then they were settling higher that day, I got a feeling that the worst of the selling was over. And so that's when I came out and postured. You know, I had a pretty impactful note that I wrote right around the turn to the bottom. In fact, I think I called it that was the turn.
Yep.
And and it just happened to work out, right? So in hindsight, there was a little bit of luck involved, but I think that it had a lot to do with just having a consistent process, Zach,
yeah.
and knowing sort of historically where these things line up. And knowing historically, you know, where you are in sentiment, it was really important to pay attention to the fact that this was the fastest trip to a bear market territory in history, right? It was the fastest 10% correction in history. It was the fastest 20% correction in history. And from experience, at 20% corrections, if the media is going to go ahead after a 20% correction and start labeling this a bear market, you know that that's the extreme where the Federal Reserve is going to say, well, we better get involved now before sentiment changes and everybody starts getting along with the fact that we're in a bear market.
Right.
Right. So that's where, you know, you have to anticipate when the Fed is in control that once things get out of control, that they're going to be back. And then once they came back, you know, and we got the Jerome Powell doing all of his Mario Draghi impersonations where they're going to do whatever it takes. And then he promised forceful, aggressive and proactive response to this. And then we threw $3 trillion on the balance sheet. And then you knew that there was something that was going to change dramatically in the world.
Yeah,
right?
It has a way of doing that, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the real deal. I mean, that's what the markets are trading on right now. And I'm not listening to anything else otherwise. I'm not listening to vaccine BS. I'm not listening to anything else. And I'm just watching the liquidity pump in play and seeing how that trades against sentiment. because now, I think that's really.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. No, it's a great point. And people, this is why I subscribe to Tony's newsletter. I just need to start listening to it more. And it's not, to be fair too, Tony, you've had a ton of great calls, man. And I don't want to, I don't mean to single this one out and say, oh, that's the one. I mean, this is why we subscribe. This is why it's one of the sources of research we pay for. This is kind of a muddy question, Tone. So you can attack it any way you want to. But something I've been thinking about, man, is throughout this whole cycle in James Jude. I think you know Jimmy Jude, don't you?
Yeah, I've heard the name. I'm not terribly familiar with his work, but I know who he is.
Another guy that was pounding the table at the bottom, and a traitor. Right. And I want to differentiate trader to investor because it's two different, very different things. And coming up in the world that I came on, I always sort of looked it sounds ridiculous saying this now, but I just want to be intellectually honest. I sort of looked down on the trading aspect because I believed in the Warren Buffett approach. We don't worry about short term turns and all this kind of stuff. And this whole cycle, this 12 year cycle we've been in. If you didn't have a trader's outlook, if you didn't incorporate that into your process, you've been completely left behind. Why is this turned into such a, and I don't want to be over the top or hyperbolic, Tony, but the traditional investment approaches, you know, like the outperformance of growth to value, right? It's an example. They really haven't worked. Tony, we've had stocks, and I've talked about this on previous shows. I have literally sat on stocks that over the 4 or 5 years we owned them, their revenues went up 50%, their margins got better, balance sheet improved, and stock didn't move. I got a list of those, right? Well, why have I been forced to learn the ways of a trader? Why has this been such a market that works that way and the traditional approaches seem to be muted?
Okay, so that's a great question and a question that I've always struggled with throughout my career, and a lot of it is sort of how do you get into the mode that the market's in.
Yeah.
Right. So that has a little bit to do with it, Zach. I would say that you have to have the right set of givens, if I can use that word, if the right set of givens in the market right now. So I'm looking at the market with a set of givens or known knowns. The number one known premise that I'm operating on is the Fed is inflating assets. And if you own assets, you're good. If you don't own assets, you're left out, right? And so I'm operating with that as a basic premise, and it's been working, broadly speaking, right? So with that premise, you have to be able to step in on dips like we're seeing and have confidence that the Fed is still inflating assets. And you have to sort of, you know, put a little bit of – there's two lenses that you have to look at the markets through now. Number one, you have to look at the market through the lens of – if there's $7 trillion on the balance sheet and liquidity abundant everywhere, and there's a banana duct taped to a wall that's trading for $100,000 at Miami and Art Basel, right? You have to
know.
True story. You have to know there are going to be distortions in the markets and everywhere, right? That's a premise, right? So you have to say, okay, we're going to have to figure out where these distortions are going to be because somebody just bought a banana on a wall for $100,000. So the world is changing. No, I'm serious. It's crazy to talk about, but I truly believe in the thought process. So, you know, we've got this set of distortions that we're going to know is going to happen, right? A lot of the distortions that we fall into as technical traders in this market, for example, and have had to come around, and I think this will help our discussion quite a bit in understanding these markets. As a momentum technician trader, you wanted to say sell the S&P when it dipped through the 50-day moving average because there should have been some follow-through or something like that, right? In the world of, you know, central bank liquidity, the 50-day moving average is just kind of an area, you know, like it's kind of like the S&P will go down to that area and hover around, and then it'll pick itself up and get back on its feet. So as a technician, you have to get used to these levels that used to be set in stone that are now just kind of vague areas of support, you know, because the sort of there's a lot of distortions. There's a lot more traders in the market. You know, things go through various levels and they're not as much of a self-fulfilling prophecy as they used to be. And then you have to look at where the distortions in the market are in terms of where the money's going to go, despite the fact that there might be a better place for it, right? Like there may be, you know, like the stock that you're talking about that's got, you know, earnings growth and margin expansion and maybe a bigger competitive advantage in the market. That stock should have been going up. Excuse me, but it's not because, excuse me, in 2020, a name like Tesla is sucking all the oxygen out of the rational thinking stock investment, right? So where there would have been guys putting the money into the value plays and saying, yeah, I'm going to put the money into this value play because I think that this company can continue to grow and expand margin and increase their competitive position. And that would have probably worked 20 years ago. Because we were highly dependent on real earnings. Now we're only dependent on liquidity, and liquidity finds its way to where money is treated best. And unfortunately, Zach, for me and you, it may not be in that stock that we love because it seems like the right company and they look like a dime on paper. And you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the liquidity, however, says, hey, man, that's a nice idea, but Tesla goes up between 12 and 20% a day, and that's really a nice place for money to be, right? So we're going to go put some money in Tesla and watch it go up 20% a day, and I love your little your little bank over here, your little investment bank, you know, that's trading at a 16, you know, multiple, but we're really not interested in that thing right now.
Yeah.
You know, because there's these disco balls flying around in the market like Salesforce.com and Apple and Tesla, and they've just split and they're sucking up all the retail oxygen in the trading room. And so that's unfortunately, that's where the money's finding itself. And that's why tech is, you know, so far out ahead of, you know, the S&P, which is so far out ahead of the Russell. And so there's another distortion, right, Zach? We just uncovered another one just in this conversation, another liquidity distortion. And maybe it's due to some of the fundamental factors of the lockdown, but tech is out and gone, right? It really exacerbated that FANG strength that we had been seeing for years before the lockdown. And then all of a sudden we got lockdown and FANG said, okay, we're out of here. And literally, we are just gone to levels above the market that people aren't even going to be able to get their heads around.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that's where we are now in tech. And tech may be, I don't know, maybe closer to fully valued. And I'm starting to look, you know my tendency, Zach. I like to stay in my natural resources lane.
Yep.
And quite frankly, from 30,000 feet up now, and we've got to benefit from some of the tech rally by being positive software and some of the other subsectors. But I feel like now, in terms of if you're looking for performance from now to the end of the year of a trade that can really work out numbers wise and generate a good return, I think you got to look towards some of the industrial sectors or commodity sectors, or, you know, something that can catch on to this let's let inflation run hot theme. Because I'm not one of those guys, Zach, that listens to Jerome Powell and has him lay out the playbook for me and goes home and says, okay, how am I going to fade this? This guy's a fraud and I'm going to fade this goddamn Federal Reserve $7 trillion balance sheet. You know what I mean? Like, you know, the market's at 185% of GDP and it can't sustain any longer because I decided that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't decide what the market's going to do. I let the market tell me what's going to do. I'm a really astute observer, and I watch market performance in indices. I watch it extremely closely on a daily basis, extremely closely on a weekly basis. As you can see, I go through the trouble of putting out a video every week because I think weekly moves are really important to key on because they play into your performance on a monthly basis. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like over a period of years and years and years, if you study that performance and try to get into some of those lanes of those sectors that are showing you the money every month, after a set of years, you find yourself having jumped into a trend that started 5 years ago when you just started noticing that the software sector was outperforming every other subsector every month. And even if they were only up 2%, it was interesting that software was up 2.25%. And then when they started going up 5%, it was interesting that software was up 11%. And you say, well, why should it be so high? Why, you know, I know I'm buying highs here, but this sector's performing every month. So let's start moving some money towards it. You know, and when you sort of notice that performance, and then that's how you don't realize it, but you catch on to a secular rally where things go up and up and up for months and months and months. And that's where I think the trading acumen can turn into investing acumen. You know, for me, where I turn into, you know, my investments come from trades that never stop me out.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like if I, you know, I'm really disciplined with getting into a trade and I'm really disciplined with getting out. I think that one of the reasons that I've survived so long is that I just hit bids and be flat and dust myself off and think about it again the next day.
Yep.
So when you have that ability and you have the ability to ditch the things in your portfolio that aren't performing when you check up on them every day, every week, every month, and move a little bit of that money into the things that are, you find yourself into you know, a trade where when you're bumping your trailing stop up, you just keep bumping it up and bumping it up. And next thing you know, it's 6 months later and you're nowhere near getting stopped out and you've got a real trade on your hands.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's sort of, to me, that's how I say, like, I've got trades in my, I call myself a trader, not an investor. But on occasion, you know, you'll get into a name like Peloton on the IPO and have the story right. And I'm still riding Peloton from the long side with a trailing stop in my trading account, you know? And so that's turned into an.
I remember when you called that, you're still on that. You've ridden this thing all the way up, huh?
Yeah, but that's it. You know, this is. Well, this is, you know, this is the kind of thing where I missed as a trader. I effing missed Peloton. Peloton should have been a trade that I basically could have retired on into 2020, but I played it too cautiously. Like Peloton is a trade that I would have liked to have waded into and kept adding. And Peloton wound up being a trade where I bought the IPO and was long it for a long time and had a lot of Peloton fatigue by the time the washout happened in March. And then when it seemed to me like everybody in the world needed a home gym and was going to turn to Peloton for that in April of 2000, instead of, you know, in increasing my position massively, I only added a little bit. So now, even, you know, while I have a pea shooter sized Peloton position, I've managed to stay in it for this long, you know, because it's been so small. And I just keep saying, okay, well, I never got my whole position on this thing because it never pulled back to where I thought I could buy it. You know what I mean? So it's one of those things where you start moving money towards something to see if it's right. And it never gives you a chance to add more because it's up and gone. And that's luck, right? That is pure, unadulterated luck, right?
But it's luck because you followed your process, right?
It's true.
It's not pure luck. This is why we have processes, right? Processes.
True. There's something to it. There's something to that for sure. But I would say I call Peloton luck because I happened to have bought a bike before the lockdown. And so I had the bike and got on it every day and saw my kids getting on it. And I'm saying, wow, this is some investment. And so when people get a hold of this and realize that how well this thing is made, et cetera, I think it's got a bright future. It seems like a great company. It's really inclusive and it's partially online and it checks all of these boxes for a company that I think a big plain vanilla would come after for months and months and months.
Yeah. No, it makes sense.
You know, I mean, and you start thinking of, okay, what's Peloton going to do next? It's like, I think they're going to, you know, we know they're going to have a treadmill. If you ask me, they're probably going to have a climbing wall and a swimming tank that you can put in your house at some point.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because they're that kind of company. So, you know, now I got to wait for Peloton to wash out and make the decision if I want to add to my small position, which is now, you know, worth a lot more than it was when I put the money in. But as a trader, I missed it. But because of my process, I've stayed in the small position and my stop loss is now below the 100-day moving average at 59.5.
Yeah.
You want to know
the opposite of that, Tony? The opposite of that is in the first week of coronavirus, buying Zoom Technologies at 103 and selling it at 125 because it went too quick, too fast.
Oh my God.
Yeah, Tony, that happened.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've done that stuff and it's heartbreaking. The ones that you let go of and that turn into something are heartbreaking. And yeah. It's all, you know, it's all, but at least Zach, you know, it all starts with having, you know, the brains and the balls, excuse my French, to start moving the money into that thing that you believe in.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where it starts. So whether it's the inflation trade or the gold trade or the, you know, or just watching Peloton and knowing that there's enough bears out there with relative voice that, you know, you're not the only bull in the room, or you're not a consensus bull in the room, which just makes it even more comfortable. And then you say, yeah, okay, this seems like a thing I can buy because there's still going to be shorts that have to cover if it goes up.
Yeah.
You know, and then next thing you know, they all get out at once. And, you know, the thing is a double away from you, and you literally can't touch the stock because you've traded it in the teens and you've traded it in the 20s. And now it's at 30 and 40. And you're like, I can't buy this year. I had this thing dead to rights where I should have had it, you know.
Yeah.
But that's all part of the game. That's part of the game. You know, like you said, if you stick to your process across these trades and keep doing the homework and watching the performance, you know, you can get yourself very cautiously into a good position over time, which is what I like about that process.
Yeah, no, man. And it's really reading your stuff has really helped me too, because, you know, like I said, in this market, for all the reasons we've just laid out, you've got to combine the two. If you're a rigorous, disciplined, you know, value type investor like I am, if you don't incorporate these types of things into your process, you're not going anywhere in this market, man. And you haven't for a decade.
You're absolutely right. I really, that's what I appreciate about you specifically, Zach, is you're a dynamic character. And, you know, I know that you wake up eyes wide open every morning and eyes and ears wide open every morning. And I think that's a great, great trait to have for a man in your position. So,
well, keep learning, right?
Yeah, no, we're students of the market. I mean, I've been doing this since I got out of college in 1990, and I wake up every day looking to learn, like literally feeling like a kid going to school, you know, saying, what's the market going to teach me today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and it's teaching a lot. So, Tony, we're looking out, and I want to run the thesis by you and see your thoughts on it, because markets go up, markets will go down. This market will have a big, nasty correction at some point. But here's the thing that I'm wrestling with is there's so much talk about the election. The angst is building up, right? We got higher volatility. Everybody's waiting for the trapdoor to open. Here's what I'm wrestling with. I don't care who wins the election. They're going to make it rain, right? The stimulus is going to be going full tilt. The Fed ain't going anywhere. Tony, am I wrong? Now, look, it's going to be a winding road. It always is. But am I wrong to be thinking that I don't think valuation's ridiculous, insane. I don't see this thing going south anytime soon. What is your read on where we're at? I just, for all the reasons that we've been talking about here in this first 20 minutes or so, I'm looking at these things and I see them growing. I see these forces getting bigger. In that wake, Tony, I don't see the big correction coming anytime really soon. Do you?
I'm very much with you, and I'm even more with you, I would say, after this week, right? Yeah. I came into this week with the NASDAQ having closed last week below its 50-day moving average for the first time. We finally got a big pullback off the highs. We finally got the big move off the highs in Apple, right? They finally stopped buying Apple and Tesla after they both split. And then we uncovered the NASDAQ whale inhaling options at the top of the freaking market in 2020, just to throw that into your 2020 bingo card, right? So we've got Masasan buying options and causing this whole hyperbolic move in tech. Tech comes all the way back to critical support and by all rights should have kept going this week. Right. Like this is something that I think maybe it's a factor of the FOMC flop factor, which I wrote about, where the market tends to just take a dip at FOMC meetings, then get on its feet and rally again. Or maybe it's another factor that people really just want to buy this dip. But I have to say that the most impressive thing to me in the markets this week is that the NASDAQ didn't take a bigger dump than it did last week.
Yeah.
You know, like that should have happened, if you ask me. So now you're looking at it and you're like, man. you know, once again, everybody's super negative only because the market demonstrated the ability to finally go down and at least change everybody's psyche. And now everybody's like, oh, wow, now maybe it can really curl over and we can get to buy something cheap. And here's the NASDAQ like, no, it's 30. You know, the NASDAQ is like, no, we're hugging the 50-day moving average. We're not curling over through it.
Right.
And the S&P is like, yeah, we're surfing the moving average higher. We're not breaking down below it. You know, and so the market is sort of telling me these things that I feel like we're going to come into a week and lack bad news. And maybe the president, you know, comes up with another optical win between now and the election and people go back to wanting to buy stocks again.
Yep.
So I do agree. I'm with you very much in that. Like, I feel that this the post lockdown rally, which has been created, is now in motion. And I feel like Jerome Powell, in the last FOMC, I guess it was at Jackson Hole when he said that they were going to let the economy, let inflation run hot. I feel like that opened up another sort of leg to this rally potentially. And that's how I'm playing it, because into that comment, we had commodities rallying. We had commodities rallying right through that. We had market-based inflation expectations ticking higher into the Fed chairman saying they're going to let it run hot. So to me, this is the trade that should continue into year end, right? Like this feels like we're in a runway position here, but we've got the election.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the major thing right now. And believe me, it's such a big thing on my mind that I'm working on this election note that I am not going to let out until it's perfect. Like, I was going to let it out today, but I'm not letting it out until it's perfect because I got a little bit more work to do on it, because this is, quite frankly, the most freaking absurd situation for a capitalist democracy to be in heading into a major election. Right. And yeah. the position that we're in is what's being socialized is the idea that we're not going to know the result.
Right. Right.
And it's like, I don't know about you, but I'm 50 years old and I've been through a lot of presidential elections at this point in my life. And I've always known who the president was the next day waking up. And the fact that they're coming at us as Americans and telling us that you're not going to know, and it's the message that's coming from, you know, the big media conglomerate and the Trump resistance that are telling you, oh, President Trump, it's going to look like he won in a landslide on election day. And then we're going to go and count all the votes. Right. So in the first time in my life, we're not doing get out the vote. We're doing mail in your vote.
Right.
Right. So this is like a 2x4 to the head. Like, what the F are you talking about? Mail in your vote. Like, all these people that are going to mail in their vote have definitely been in a Costco or a CVS within 24 hours of having mailed in that vote. So there's literally no reason why people can't go vote in person. But we know that there's somebody out there that's going to try to steal the election. Period.
Yeah.
Full stop. Out in the open. You know what I mean? It's George Soros and the like. They're on the tape. They're out there, you know, being aggravators. They're out there doing everything they can to dismantle Donald Trump. And they just do not care about the will or the vote of the people that voted him into office. Right. So Now we've got the situation that we've got now where everybody is saying, OK, we're going to have massive volatility heading into this. And so maybe there is going to be massive volatility, but guess what's going to happen if everybody's loaded up long vol and we go into the election and the stock market doesn't cave?
It's going to rip.
They're going to sell their vol and the market's going to go parabolic. Yeah. Especially, would you doubt that the market went parabolic in the event of a Trump landslide?
Oh, no, it'll go ballistic.
Right, right. And I think that the market, first of all, by not backing off, is trying to tell you that it is, in my opinion, telegraphing an incumbent victory where we still got a president that's got his, you know, proverbial, you know, foot on the neck of the Fed chairman, without using too bad of an analogy there now that I think about it. But he's definitely pressuring Jerome Powell to, it was a clear thing. Jerome Powell showed up like he was going to normalize the balance sheet. And Donald Trump said, wait a minute. My predecessor just had 8 years of balance sheet expansion, and you think on my watch you're gonna raise rates and normalize the balance sheet? Forget it.
Well, I don't even know if it was Trump, man. I think the market took him out back and paddled him and just said that
could
the,
be
the hell you're not, right? I mean, that was so funny when he was talking tough there at the end of 2018, yeah. And the market just free fell, just went, okay, if you're not yeah. playing ball, man, we're leaving. And then he yeah. Did his about face, came sprinting out of the Eccles building and said, no more rate hikes, you know?
Yeah, well, that was a great narrative. That's when Stan Druckenmiller came on Real Vision and said, listen, it's going to be one of these rate hikes that topples the market. The next rate hike, the freaking not stock market toppled. And that was the beginning of it, right? That was, yep. we had 10-year yields above 3% when that was happening. You know what I mean?
Crazy. Yeah, it seems crazy yeah. now, right?
It seems crazy now. Now that we're pinned to zero for, you know, till ad infinitum, apparently. But yeah, it was a different world. And me, okay, look, so let's look from 30,000 feet up. Maybe it was the president, maybe it wasn't. But the one thing that's for sure is that the dominant theme in this market that it's being run and operated on is Fed liquidity, not who's the president.
Hey, this is something that I've been talking about for a while, and just want to run it by you. Feel free to agree or disagree.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've been saying for a while, or a theory of mine, is just that with Fed involvement and government stimulus, you know, you look at this year, you know, federal spending will be what? Probably by the end of the year, probably looking at 40-45% of GDP, you know, maybe?
Yeah. I don't even know the data, but that sounds about right.
Yeah, somewhere in that ballpark. And if it doesn't hit that level this year, and we're getting to that number, Tony, just by looking at the current rate of you know, the current deficit pace, and then, you know, saying that, look, another stimulus package is going to happen. Yep. And then at some point in the next, you know, 4 to 6 months, you're going to get an infrastructure bill. You know, so saying, okay, maybe it doesn't actually fall in this calendar year, but in the next 12 months, you know, you're going to be growing at a rate where the deficit's going to be, you know, somewhere in that 35-45% of GDP range. And you know, thinking about it sounds crazy, saying those numbers. And we were talking about the you know, what that the impact that that's going to have on markets. And one of the things that I like to think about, because, well, I think we all fall victim to this, is thinking, you know, this is crazy. This is the only time this has ever occurred. This is a completely unique scenario. And I want to throw this one at you, because I'm looking at this way. When I look at this market, I sit there and I go, you know, it's amazing to me that we're here. With, if you look at the U6 report, you know, we're looking at, you know, 14.5% unemployment.
Yeah.
We're looking at a GDP contraction somewhere between, you know, by the end of the year, 7-10%. Biggest hit to GDP in a single calendar year since the Great Depression. And yet we've got markets at record highs and record high valuations. Have we ever been anywhere like this? Is there any period in time comparable to where people know, you know, I think intelligent investors and people that pay attention, they know that these stocks they're printing money with are ridiculous. They know it's not connected to reality. Yet at the same time, we know what the driver is and it makes sense. Have we ever been in anywhere close to this? Is there any comp historically?
I think no freaking chance. I think that this is the most unique market situation that I've ever seen since I've been following markets, right? It's you know, I if you want to go back to, you know, what the reality of this is, I like to go back to Paul Tudor Jones' quote, where, you know, I wish I might be able to dig it up, but he basically calls this, you know, the most outrageous monetary experiment. You know, it was his quote. It was his quote, essentially, that was backing his bullishness in gold and bullishness in Bitcoin. But he was like, you know, this is the most insane monetary experiment that has ever taken place. And I feel like that sort of captures it right there, Zach. You know, like, precious metals markets wouldn't be percolating to all time highs if this wasn't the craziest scenario ever. You know, like, Bitcoin wouldn't be rallying to 10,000 and beyond if this wasn't, you know, one of the craziest fiscal and monetary situations the world has ever seen. So we're literally in a situation where the world is trying to figure out where liquidity should be going. you know, like in a liquidity, when the liquidity is coming out of the spigot, should it be going into Bitcoin? Should it be going into Tesla? Should it be going into the bond market? Because that seems to never stop. Like, you know, there are a lot of good places to put your money right now. And so it's a really, really interesting dynamic. And the question is that, you know, I've kind of hung my hat on the fact that the trickle down theory is bullshit. You know, and that we're starting to see the extremes of that now, where I think it's being proven to be BS because, you know, the wealth gap is exploding with the balance sheet, right? Yeah. So the people that own securities are such a minor percentage of the population, except we're the ones that are getting bailed out and saved here. And you got to think about, imagine if you didn't have a dollar in this market that you could say, oh, well, at least, you know, I've got my nest egg is intact, or at least, you know, I've got some capital behind me if in a case of emergency or a job loss. And so that's when you really feel for the lower and middle class that don't have a piece of this pie, you know, and then you see it manifesting itself in, you know, and people wonder why Davey Day Trader is so popular. And he's just the everyman that showed people how to bang their way into the stock market.
And he's on the right narrative, right? That's the funny thing. Yeah. Is he takes a lot of flack, but he's right. In this environment, when stocks go down, they're going to pump. I mean, it's
uncanny. It's uncanny that this guy has stepped into this market and his strategy and timing happened to be perfect. And I'm not fading him. I'm not fading him.
No way. I'm not touching either. Okay. So the thing the other thing I wanted to run by you is something that in this environment, given the backdrop that we just laid out, that the Fed's going to keep pumping. And I want to come back to that because I think it's a really interesting thing that people aren't paying enough attention to. But one of my theories has been because the Fed and central banks have been such a main player that I believe that the markets have morphed temporarily. They'll come back around at some point. You know, when God only knows, but they have gone from being a price discovery mechanism to a liquidity gauge. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, totally.
And if the liquidity is pumping, they're going to go up. It's that simple, right?
Yeah. That's, you know, it's like, it's one of the things, Zach, where you learn, you know, you better learn quickly to let the market tell you where it's going, right? Because if you try to construct a view of the world and then force it on the markets, the market will prove you wrong. Right. So this is just like a typical thing. Like none of us thought that NASDAQ was going to go to this price after the lockdown. If you would have asked any of us in April, May or June, you know, do you think the NASDAQ makes a new high? We probably still would have said, nah, man, like how could that happen? Like, no, it's going to retrace to the highs and then maybe stop. And then next thing you know, because we're in a new paradigm and, you know, the tech is benefiting from the perfect storm of the lockdown, the NASDAQ is gone. There's just so many different, I may be getting away from the answer here, but there's so many distortions created and it's all so original and there's so much, you know. I feel like the VIX at 25-30 answers the question, right? It says that even though stocks are up here, nobody knows what the F is going to happen next.
Yeah.
You know, so I feel like that's a little bit of the dizzying heights fear about this market. But when you, like you said, the mechanism is they're inflating assets. And if you get in the right position, you're going to be inflated alongside them.
Yeah. Well, one of the other things we started digging into along this line of talking is realizing that, you know, you look at the previous, I mean, if we look at 99, you look at 08-09, that was preceded. Mm-hmm. Those were preceded. And I'm not saying it's the singular cause or anything, but they were preceded by interest rates going up, right? 99, they pulled back the wave of liquidity to get through Y2K. You know, that seemed, you know, it's funny, Tony, I'm old enough to remember when Y2K seemed like a big deal.
That was like the great monster under the bed that you had to get through, you know, and it was like, oh my God, this is going to be terrible.
Little did we know, right?
It was nothing.
And so one of the things people thought, well, the Fed can't keep this up. We've approached it over time, especially after coronavirus, looking at it the flip side. And in some of our research, you know, and it's not hard, but it was just an observation that we uncovered, which was, you know, the deficit, the government spending being as big a percentage of GDP as it is now, that the very act if the Federal Reserve did tighten and got back to some kind of sane policy that was mirroring, you know, what they've done in the past. They're so entrenched at this point. The liquidity has run so much and for so long, and prices have gone so high that we looked at the setup and went, you know, if the government balanced its budget like we did in 99, if the government balanced its budget, that would have a hit to, you'd probably see a 7 to 9% hit to GDP, which is a contraction that is double what we had during the financial crisis. Right. And that's the aspect that I think a lot of bears aren't looking at, is that the Fed has done all of this to avoid a financial crisis type event. They're not stupid. They know that if they pulled back, if we got on sane fiscal footing, right, they're monetary. Right. I know they're not fiscal, but I'm just saying in general, right, if the government got back on a sane fiscal footing, if the Fed got back on a sane monetary footing, that alone would cause the crisis that they've been trying to prevent for the last 10 years. Right.
Sure would. Sure would. That's why we can't go there.
Right. And so they're handcuffed to this thing. Right.
Yeah.
They can't pull. And I think in a short period of time, as in the next 16 months, I think they're going to be looking at a different threat. And I think they're on the verge of it right now. And you could make the argument again. You've got, you know, unemployment levels we haven't seen since the Great Depression and markets at all time highs and all time high valuations. I think that we could see a scenario where they're looking at each other in the Eccles building going, guys, this is out of control. How do we get out of this now? Right?
Imagine if we do get the 2.7% headline CPI, you know, what the world will look like. I mean, you're going to talk about stagflation. I mean, you just went over the unemployment side of that equation. Imagine if prices roof. Oh. Imagine if a quart of milk is $9. Imagine if a gallon of gas is $7 in the US. I mean, dude. You know, we're talking about a situation that the Fed is going to have to take the balance sheet to 14T to keep the stock market up, and they will.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the mindset that I'm trying to operate under until proven wrong, because I feel like, you know, we started this policy in 2008. I finally caught on to it in 2010 or 11. And, you know, we're still in the middle of it, and it doesn't look like it's going to change, like you just said, because what is the mechanism that they, you know, take our national debt down with, or take the balance sheet down with, or something fiscally or monetarily responsible, God forbid. And my, you know, the thing is, man, it doesn't, you know, it seems like that's a unicorn that's dead and gone now.
Well, yeah, right? I was telling this in a note to our clients that we put out last month, where I just said, listen, guys, you know, like Trump, hate Trump, whatever the case may be, the one thing that we all need to accept, because I was getting this question from tons of clients. It was like, Zach, at some point we got to get it back on the right track, right? We got to get back on sound footing. And I put out a note to all of them and said, guys, that ship sailed decades ago.
Yeah,
And the terminology we're using now, and again, feel free to critique it, but the terminology we're using now is that we're saying that this is terminal. And not terminal as an imminent, but terminal is inevitable, meaning that that we are at a point now where, till the, you know, for the foreseeable future and even beyond that, the Fed will be involved, and the U.S. government will be involved. There will be forms of stimulus. Maybe it's MMT. Maybe it's a UBI. Right. Yeah. Rates pegged at zero. QE. Meaning that we're at a point now where there is, in my opinion, there is no normalizing. There's no normalizing. Yeah, it's a permanent fixture. Right. Until the whole thing blows up.
Exactly. The monetization hammer is going to get applied to every problematic nail, no matter what type of nail sticks itself into the, you know, Fed's version of what the market should be. And their answer is going to be to come back with a monetization hammer and a bigger balance sheet and more stimulus and lower rates for longer. And that's all they have now. So, you know, we could be getting to a point, right? Like, we've got yields at zero in the 10-year pretty much. And we're almost about to go negative in the 2-year. You know, we didn't plan on going to negative rates. You know, it seems like we may have to go another angle and add another leg of stimulus, whether it's a package and infrastructures, you know, something fiscal, something like that. So all I think is that at some point it's coming. You know, yeah. it's hard to trade the markets with the helping factor as the unknown, sort of the driving factor is the unknown out there. But when you get confidence in the pattern and know that every nail that presents itself is greeted with a Federal Reserve monetization hammer, right? Whether the problem is, a liquidity problem like we had with the Lehman fallout, whether it was a market crash like we had with the dot-com bubble, whether it is a mortgage crisis, the Fed is going to come at it with more monetization, same solution, right? So at this point, once we crossed the Rubicon and went from 4 to 7 trillion, I mean, in my mind, we'll be going from 14 to 17 trillion before we know it, And for whatever reason, Zach, the market is sustaining that. And I'm not saying it's right, but I've heard more guys get carried out on the premise, applying the idea that sort of, quote, there's no free lunch for the markets, right? Like we're going to have to come back. We're going to have to pay the piper for all of this debt at some point in the future. But as long as the market perceives, growth as being there or just, economic functionality being there for some reason, the market is withstanding this, it's withstanding everything that's being thrown at it because the liquidity is working. So in some case, if you believe that there's no free lunch, you're getting carried out because I've been taken out to lunch thousands of times. And it seems like right now the market is operating on a free lunch principle.
Yeah, it is. I've been carried out multiple times too, just, thinking, okay, we've got to get back to a rational place. We've got to get back to, valuation
right.
matter. And, there is a practical side to it though, because one of the, again, thinking outside the box, one of the things that we spent a lot of time thinking about is that, the reason mechanically speaking, the reason markets go up when the economy is going up is because the economy is growing. It's creating more capital, and that capital has got to find a room, mm-hmm. right? It's got to find a place. And that's a productive economy. When the economy goes into recession, there's less capital, prices shrink. And it's like the Fed and the government are just stepping in and doing the job of the economy, right? They're just providing that excess liquidity, and it's got to find a home.
Yeah. And then how about that? The economy, before you jump in and want to fade the market on every pullback, consider what we just had coming into this week. We basically had M&A Monday coming into this week in the tech market. Right. We had Nvidia buying ARM from SoftBank, and we had Alibaba putting $3 billion into Grab, and like all kinds of tech synergies taking place. So my point is, like, the Fed is there to supply the liquidity when, the market wants to go south. And then the market is there with its own, bullish characteristics that sort of lifted out of the hole. Like, go try to fade the NASDAQ when, there's M&A going on in the semiconductor sector.
Yeah.
And the semiconductor sector is going up 5% a day. Like, go fade that, what's your plan for getting out of that?
Yeah.
So that's why, when you come around to bull market trading and you have confidence, like, okay, something's going to pick us up out of this hole. I don't know whether it's the Fed. I don't know whether it's going to be a merger or an acquisition or something bullish for the tape. But the tape seems to keep coming up with things that the market can hang its hat on. And so I hate fading that.
Except value, Tony.
Well, value's dead. We know that. We know that, Zach. I mean, we learned that a long time ago.
That's the one number on the bingo card that hasn't been called, right?
Right. Exactly. All of a sudden, value will rally this year, and then everybody will know the year is over.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Then we will have seen everything.
The return of value is starting to feel like the second coming of Christ, right? It's being
literally
anticipated, and we're left waiting. Now, to flip it though, there was an interesting little, it was actually just yesterday, little Twitter conversation that you were involved in that I jumped in on. The talk was, as an investor, I am loving this talk of, every time I hear Jim Cramer say that oil and energy companies are uninvestable, I just get giddy.
Yeah.
Where are you seeing that? To me, looks like a screaming opportunity. You also made a point too, where you said I believe this was you. I'm pretty sure it was where you said, look, the time to buy oil and energy companies is when they're expensive, not when they're cheap. And if you look at the PE ratios on these things, they look expensive because their earnings have been obliterated. What do you see in oil markets, and why are you and I, well, I can speak for myself, but I get excited when my fundamental views line up with your trading takes. Why are we targeting oil here, and what do you see? What do you see in terms of oil's up? Why are you bullish on oil?
No, absolutely, Zach. So, you know, it's important to me as a guy with an energy and commodity background to be ahead of what's going on in the oil market as best I can, right? You know, the market has been obviously super, super quiet and low volatility through the whole summer, right? Crude oil was basically a slowly climbing animal from $35 to $40, call it. Let's just call it that for our discussion purposes, right? Then we had, all of a sudden, we had a two-week pullback where oil fell, you know, like 15% from 42 to 35. And I didn't see any cause for that. But as a trader, I'm pissed that I missed this two, you know, back-to-back weeks where it could have been an easy trade to be short oil. But I just, number one, I never have the inclination to be short oil at the cost of production. So that's a commodity trader. That's a rule that I like to abide by, because next thing you know, in commodities, nothing cures low prices in commodities like low prices.
Low prices, right.
Right, right. So for just that reason alone, I am only a bull market oil trader south of $60. So with that sort of wake up trading premise, we had this 2 week pullback, and I go and stick my nose into the energy market. I start talking to my contacts, and I'm like, why did oil back off? I see no reason, right? And as it turns out, it was a very maybe a hard to detect slowdown literally in the purchases from China and India. Right. India is been a massive oil consumer. They're still in the middle of a lockdown. They've got like 270 million people locked down, and their gasoline consumption collapsed. So that was a little bit of a part of what happened with that 2 week slide that we just came out of. And then you start kicking tires on the local markets, and you see that local gasoline is still, you know, $1.85 backwardated. That curve is totally intact. It doesn't look like we're going into this bearish tailspin scenario in oil where the market goes contango. Traders start shipping storage out on tankers to store it out there to take advantage of the contango market. So since it doesn't seem like we're heading into that scenario, I'm remain bullish oil. You know, we slipped on a banana peel there with slower India and China numbers. So I remain bullish the commodity. Now, Zach, that's to say that if I am bullish, I'm going to get long the commodity and not the stocks, because this is a situation where I think oil can go up. And I think bounces in energy stocks may still be used to sell them, right? I'm a big proponent of watching performance on the year, especially this time of year, where a lot of times you see a continuation of the trend that's in place, right? The trend that's in place right now is people are selling energy stocks this year. In 2020, if you try to raise money for an energy fund, you'd have gotten the phone hung up on in your face.
Oh yeah.
100 times over, right?
Yep.
Click, no interest in energy, thank you. So we are definitely at the point where the stocks are getting thrown out like the baby with the bathwater. At some point from this level, they will rise. But my fear still, Zach, is that the ESG trading is still starting to take over the narrative. Right. The environmental, social and governance conscious investor types who are shunning all fossil fuels. Right. The Larry Finks of the world, you know, the Norway sovereign fund who pitched all of their fossil fuel exposure. You know, then you've got British Petroleum coming out and trying to get on the right side of ESG, saying that they're downgrading demand growth in oil for the next, you know, foreseeable future. You know, they're just poo pooing everything fossil fuel to try to curry political favor with the markets.
Yeah, we're selling we're selling energy companies because they're immoral, and we're taking that money and buying Facebook.
Yeah, no, that's we are doing that. That is what we did this year. Absolutely. Yeah. The fossil fuels are woke. You know, selling fossil fuels is woke. You know, people get to feel good about their investment if they, you know, I put it this way. I followed some money right in because I just thought that this was going to be a popular shape of the S&P to invest in. So I put a small amount of money in an investment account in a BlackRock ESG fund that's performing beautifully, knock on wood. But all it is a recarving of the S&P into who doesn't have a carbon footprint.
Regardless of the negative impacts they're having on the culture, right? We're just going to focus on that one thing.
Exactly. Well, that's how we stay focused on that one thing, and we don't focus on the fact that Silicon Valley is trying to tilt an election right now, right? we could focus on the fact that they hate oil because it's bad for the environment, right?
Well, and that's kind of the environment that we're living in, right? And this is one of the things that we've talked about, where it's this zero gravity environment. And I think it has a lot to do with the Federal Reserve and with the government's, you know, deficits and all this kind of thing, which is, you know, one of the ways to look at all this stimulus and everything is it's basically a suspension of gravity, right?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
And the same craziness that we're it's fascinating to me, Tony, because this is not the first time, and this is actually the way it typically works, which is, you know, the madness we're seeing in the culture is just being mirrored in the financial markets, right? The same type of dynamics are going on. The only difference with the madness going on in the market is most people like it. The madness going on in the culture, most people don't. But things are untethered, right? I mean,
they are.
And that's why I'm with you on this point. If you want to step in front of that train and fade it, I had a client that wanted to short Tesla, and he got all ticked at me because I wasn't getting back to him fast enough on puts. And if he's out there, hey, I love you. I'm not picking on you, but if he's listening. The thing that I told him was, I said, look, if you want to jump in front of this train, you go ahead and do it. And I go, the reason we're not doing this in your account, the reason I'm not going to do this for you is pull up a chart, man. And what you're betting on is a return of sanity and a return of gravity. And I'm looking at you telling you that, hey, when it returns, then short it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's not there right now.
Right now, look out your window, man. We're not in the sanity mode. Right. Like, that's easy to tell, Zach. We ain't there. We ain't there. So that, I respect that.
Another analogy we've used is, hey, you don't walk into Home Depot and get angry that they don't have good Italian food. Right. That's not what they sell. Recognize where you're at, what you're in. Right. Value doesn't matter. Will it at some point? Sure, it will. Yeah. Markets aren't permanently broken. We'll get back to it. But we're not there. And until we're there, you know, that's why I love Mark Cohodes, his whole saying, you know, I'm not going to wrestle a cheetah out of a tree. I'm going to wait till it climbs down itself. Yeah. And that's the approach you got to take. Right. This still is not a tape to short. Am I wrong?
Oh, 100%, man. I love you for that perspective. I love you for mentioning Mark Cohodes, who is such an inspiration to me and as honestly has taught me from the first interview that he did with Grant Williams, literally the lesson of stop trying to wrestle the jaguar in the tree.
Right.
Like, you know, it's one of the things that really pulled me, you know, I've come back to, in this bull market that we're in, I've really come back to my roots as a bull market trader, and have been trying to identify securities that are trading from the bottom left to the top right of my screen, and putting the pressure on myself to get into them, rather than, you know, looking at something, saying that it's wrong, saying that it's crazy, and climbing up to fight that jaguar when, you know, the jaguar is living happily up in that tree. And guess who's going to get thrown out? It's going to be you. Now, like you say, at some point, you know, reality is going to creep up on the jaguar, like reality creeped up on Enron and WorldCom and everything else that, you know, exposed fraud and you know, the crazy blood company with whatever her name is, right? So reality is going to creep into Tesla and ground it. And it's going to be such an easier trade to short Tesla from 1,000 to 500 than it is to be short from 2000 trying to pick a top.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's going to be clear that, you know, Elon's grapes are going to be nailed to the wall, and they're going to have him dead to rights on doing something fugazi, and the company is going to tumble like Enron did. But let's wait until that comes out to tackle the damn thing, because right now, you know, she's just, you know, kicking competitors out of the tree, and I don't want any part of it.
Oh man.
So
that's
the story.
Yeah, no, it's a speeding freight train, and I don't mean to dog. I love Tesla Q, man. You guys have got, I'm with you.
Yeah.
I'm with you in
100%.
Spirit, right? I'm with you in spirit. I'm with you in reality. And I tip my cap, because you guys have got more stones than I do. I'm not stepping in front of that train.
They're an incredible group. We need people like that to keep the market honest. And then at the same time, I love it when my buddy picks me up in his Tesla and we peel away from my house and it doesn't make any noise. Like, I'll be honest with you. I have no problem with that either.
No. Well, and that's the thing, right? One of the things, again, another conversation we've had with clients is, look, guys, the companies don't deter – well, Tesla's a unique situation. But in general, when we're sitting here saying that this is insane, there's nothing against the company. You know, like, take a look at a Shopify. Like, I think they got a great company, and they got a great product, and it's not their fault that markets ran their stock up to, you know, what is it, 80 times sales or something like that, 70 times sales. Right? This is just these are market conditions, and you either adapt to them or, like you put it, you get carried out on your shield.
Yeah. I learned that lesson by paying for it. Zach, you know what
I mean? That's how we all learned it, right?
That's how I learned it, from paying for it. I look at markets now and I beg them to tell me which way they're going, and I pray that I can catch on, right? Rather than saying, I'm a master of the universe. I see dollar yen down here, or the S&P at 2,500, and I'm going to put those positions on until the market agrees with that. You know what I mean? That's the fastest way to go bankrupt I can think of.
Well, because I'm the one guy that's got it figured out.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. Of course. Of course, we all had that in our brains at some point, right? It seemed so obvious. Growing up as a trader in the markets, and then you realize, like, wow, this is getting expensive. Maybe I should change my mode or my plan of attack here.
Yeah.
And
this is a fascinating conversation, because I want to bounce this off you, because it's something I've learned. Because I think we all go through that, especially if you have an IQ that is, you know, north of 100, which virtually all of us do. But you, there's that self-importance. There's that belief that you're talented, right? And in my case, I've had some really prescient calls that back that up. And in some ways, they were the worst things that ever happened to me. Because what you realize listening to Paul Tudor Jones, and what you realize listening to Druckenmiller, is they're not – first of all, I think they're both brilliant, but that's not why they win. They win because they listen to the market better than the rest of us.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know what I mean? They win because they know when to be there and when not to be.
Right.
You know, that's my thing. That's my thing, is to know when it's appropriate to be trading your idea, and when it's completely inappropriate and you should be out of the way just watching.
Right.
You know, and if I had gotten that right when I was a young 20 something, I would have a lot more money in my trading account today. I'll tell you that.
You and me both, pal. Okay. So we're in agreement, oil. What are your thoughts? We've picked up a couple, back in the dip, you know, March, maybe it was April. We picked up some nat gas. Do you have any thoughts on nat gas?
To be honest with you, I tend to stay away from and only observe nat gas, Zach. You know,
okay.
It's really something that I don't feel like I've had an effective enough edge ever in my opinions on it, or in my ability to trade it, to really make it something that I want to focus on.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean? It's the kind of thing where I try my hardest to understand it, and I try to sometimes express risk in it. More times than not, it's like a Costanza trade for me. You know what I mean? Where it's like, no, it's like, wow, no matter what I do, like, you know what I mean? If I came up bullish and put on a bearish position, that would go wrong too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you can't get anything right. And so that's why I be honest with you, I avoid natural gas. I leave that up to the experts. When I want to know something about natural gas, I call up a couple of natural gas brokers who are usually the smartest guys in the game, because they're talking to every single producer and other brokers out there. And, you know, usually natural gas is a question of, would they turn on the pipes? Is there a lot coming out, or is there none coming out?
Right.
And so I don't have any ability to be able to game whether that's going in any particular direction. I will say this, like other commodities, I wouldn't short natural gas at $2 with all the money in the world, having it seen it go to 11 from $2, I think twice in my career now. You know, it's just one of those commodities that I don't short at nominally small numbers, because it makes no sense in terms of chasing payout.
Gotcha. Okay, so we've got the oil one, and I read your letters. Vast majority of our listening audience probably doesn't. And just as a quick plug, before I forget to do this, you guys, Tony puts out a letter every single day, and going over all the events in the market. It's a great summary. If you're a home gamer, I think it's one of the best, if not the best thing to subscribe to, because it's daily. Well, Tony, it's just perfect for the guys that want to run their own money, right? But don't have the time to put into it, because I manage our portfolio, and I think it's valuable just because it's such a condensed way to look at the markets, right? It's almost like you're chewing the food for us.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I try to be laser focused on what's really important, and people have come come to appreciate that.
Right.
I have to say that. Yeah.
And before I forget to say this, you can get Tony's daily letter and weekly video now by going to tgmacro.com, correct?
Yes, that's right. You sign up for the Morning Navigator newsletter.
Yep. Yep. Okay. And which we do, I strongly recommend. Now,
thank you.
Oh yeah, man. I'm not saying it to be nice, man. It's good work.
You're the best.
Where are we going though? What is the play now? What are you focused outside of oil? You've got a little bit of Peloton. Where are the other places that you're thinking that we should be deploying capital at this point? What do you like? What don't you like? Where do you think the place to be is?
Yeah, I like inflation plays with the Fed saying they're going to let inflation run hot. I'm encouraged by the fact, believe it or not, that my former manager, Lloyd Blankfein, just went sort of public and made a statement that he thinks commodities are a good bet down here. Well, they're very much unloved. And that's what I love about commodities down here. Zach, if you didn't notice, we went on a round robin tour in the last probably 3 or 4 years where every single investment bank, one by one, shut down their commodity business. Right. So that's one of the big picture signals to me that we're getting to the sort of sleeping levels in commodities, waiting for something to happen. So that makes me bullish the commodity space. The way that metals have been performing since the Federal Reserve went batshit crazy with the balance sheet is really encouraging to me, to the idea that metals are really going to benefit from this reflation trade. So I've been moving money into things like, you know, like you've seen on my view matrix, I'm trying to trade these natural resources plays where, you know, I'm moving into XME, industrial metals and mining. I've moved into DBC, which is basically a broad commodity play, because in addition to market-based inflation expectations ticking higher, we're seeing the commodity markets rally, right? Like we're seeing like every other day, it's like I call it the baton pass of right. Which commodity is going to be in the lead every morning. And it seems to be where you wake up every morning and it's either iron ore or gold or silver or copper or soybeans now or natural gas or something that just goes berserk to the upside in the commodity markets. And I think a lot of that has to do with people clinging to hard assets and trying to trade hard assets through this currency debasement mode that we're in now. And also because, quite honestly, a weaker dollar and stronger euro should be really, really positive for the commodity space. So, you know, if we're going to be in this more secular trend now, and I'm not a dollar bear in terms of the dollar losing its reserve status, but rather now I'm just a dollar bear because the chart says that it can go lower. And if the dollar can go lower, then that's really good for the commodity trades that I've put on. And I think that those can continue. And then the other two spaces that I'm looking at that are kind of offshoots of that, that I think are going to be in great shape for the rest of the year and going forward. Home builders are really my number one sector, Zach. That's the one that sort of it's been spiking so sharply that people can't buy it. It's been a little bit difficult for people to get their heads around this trade, but to me, it's a complete perfect storm, man.
It's funny you bring this up, man. That's the third biggest question in our book is ITB.
Great.
Yeah.
It's about
rates, man, right? I mean, they're going to keep pushing mortgage rates. If the housing market starts to stall, you know, I'm fully expecting in the next 16 months to see 30-year money with a one handle on it. Call me crazy,
absolutely. But
we know the game they're going to play, right?
Absolutely. So that's just one component of it, Zach. I mean, the other components of it, of the builder trade that we have are, so we've got the low rates for the buying and the refis. Then we've got, you know, this situation now where we've got people literally running from the blue cities out to the suburbs, right? And where the real estate activity that has been taking place in the suburbs due to my channel checks and calling friends that are in real estate, these guys can't leave their phone, right? Because everybody in New York City has got a market sell order on their apartment right now, and they're trying to find a place in the suburbs to get their family away from the violence and crime. So that's taking place across a number of cities in the country where we've got this big, huge, mad rush to the burbs. And then on top of that, we've got COVID, which is likely changing the landscape of everybody's home work environment to the point where, you know, we're all going to be working from home, I feel like, either part of the time or a full time.
Yeah.
You know, and so now everybody that's moving out is building out because now they need to build out a home office. They need to furnish the home office with every sector of technology that you see exploding off the screen, from internet to cybersecurity to semiconductors to software to social media, right? They need it all. And they need it all out in the suburbs. And so this builder trade to me is just, you know, it's just getting going. It's snowballing. If you follow the builders themselves, they have got confidence to the moon, like I said, because they've got work on their docket as far as they can see. And it's starting to reflect in the earnings.
Yep.
And that's, you know, and that's why builder confidence is riding high. And I feel like that's something that can continue to ride high. If builder confidence was able to hold in through the lockdown, then it's definitely going to stay firm when they get back out there and start building more homes again. And people are actually moving into them.
Yeah.
So I just feel like this is, you know, potentially red hot sector of the markets. You know, and then I, you know, we do our own work on the house over here, and you show up at Home Depot and Lowe's, and the line is out the door still. You know, and those are two big drivers of the XHB index. And you've got Whirlpool and Williams-Sonoma, some of the other retailer and finishing companies in there. And you look down the list and you're like, man, look at these charts. Which one don't I want to be long? So I think that's a good secular trend to get in on. And I'm super bullish for the, you know, longer term future in home builders than I could possibly be in anything like tech or something like that, you know?
Yeah, no, and I agree with you. The other interesting thing, too, is and maybe you touched on this. I don't think you did. But one of the other things that I find really appealing is the macro winds are at its back in terms of, you know, the millennials. You know, what is the average age of a millennial now? Is 30, 31 years old. I mean, we're getting into household formation time, right?
Well, you know, the story, Zach, this is a great part of the trade to talk about right now, because the dynamic and the storyline has been, for a year or 2 years since they've been rallying, or 3 years since the builders have been a really good sector, is that, oh, the millennials aren't buying homes. They're not going to buy any homes. They're going to rent for the rest of their lives, and they don't like owning anything. And it's like, well, the numbers have never corroborated that, right? We're long builders in the newsletter, right? So we follow every time we come out with new home sales and existing home sales, and those numbers just keep getting better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I'm trying to think of, like, how is it possible that millennials aren't buying homes? Who's buying them if these numbers just keep roofing every month? You know what I mean?
So yeah, there has to be an influx, right?
There is. I think that the narrative that millennials won't buy a home is totally wrong. And I feel like, you know, they're going to be even driven even more to buy a home, even if they didn't want one, given what's happening to a lot of major cities where they've been able to hide out in a small apartment for, you know, once they realize that they get a lot more bang for their buck in the suburbs, maybe they'll conform and come out here and build a house and buy a house. And that'll be good for the sector. But that's stretching a little bit.
And it's cheaper than living in the city, man. So they'll have more free change to throw at the Robinhood account, right?
Yeah, exactly. There's so much to think about. There's so much to think about with the builders. So
yeah. Okay. Now, we've sucked up a lot of your time here, but in closing, where are we? Do you think that this tech rally keeps extending? Does it last as long? Is tech a function of, you know, I get the connection it's got to interest rates. I get the connection it's got to the weak economy because tech's growing regardless. Where do you think, and again, you know, I don't mean to put you on a spot, and nobody's got a crystal ball, but where do you think we're at in the tech rally? Obviously, we were, you know, due for a pause. But do you think tech keeps leading the way?
No. I think from here that it's going to be difficult for tech to really, really explode, right? We saw the big outperformance, and then we just identified this whale that just entered the market at the highs, right? So at some level, I feel like this guy is going to have to live underwater. Right. He may be right in the long run, and the tech, you know, secular rally is probably very much well intact here. But when I look at, like, what kind of percentage returns that I could conceive tech generating from here, I keep getting reminded that, like, when Nokia split 4-for-1, I think it was in April of 2000. You know what I mean? And the NASDAQ peaked in March, and we never saw the level again for however many years. And sort of I'm concerned that we may be, broadly speaking, in a scenario like that where we're sort of, you know, we're sort of loaded to the boat with tech, right? Mm-hmm. We've got tech up to the gills. You know, we've got tech sucking up all the oxygen in media. We've got everybody long tech. We've got Apple and FANG stocks leading the market. So, I mean, how much better can it get for tech on this side of a 4-for-1 Apple split and 5-for-1 Tesla split? You know, so that's where I
well,
I feel
are they
like,
going to? But are the Googles, are they going to follow suit? Do you think we're waiting for a bunch more stock splits? Quite honestly, I'm surprised you haven't seen them.
Yeah, exactly. I do, because I think that, you know, no matter whether we like it or not, they're good for this new retail component in the market. You know, I mean, Apple split and went up for another 4 days before it peaked out at 138 and finally had an outside day just due to literally buyer fatigue.
Well, and the narrative behind that, Tony, was as scary as it was funny. Listening to these videos, people saying, look, a stock split is where you own one stock and then the company gives you three or four more just for free.
Yeah. Literally. Like the narrative is enough to drive you crazy. So that's why I feel like, broadly speaking, I'm cautious. I'm super cautious about getting into tech after this run.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like what they really need to try to do is lift some of the other boats in the markets, like, you know, get some of the industrial sectors going again. And, you know, like we said, like builders and like transportation and like maybe aerospace and defense. And, you know, if maybe some of the, I feel like some of the manufacturing and industrial sectors can perform better than tech from here through the rest of the year. But I am expecting everything to sort of continue to rally between now and the rest of the year. The thing is, like, you know, the thing with me that I just want to make sure that I make clear is that identifying this NASDAQ whale, buying options like a crazy drunken sailor at the top of the market and causing all kinds of moves, I feel like the market is not done digesting that yet. So I was looking for tech to curl over this week. It didn't happen. You know, NASDAQ is kind of pretty much unchanged on the week, I think. You know, maybe it's a little lower, but you know, I want to be on guard that it can maybe pull back further so I can get in, because I think the secular trend is intact. But yeah, if I had to pick a direction, you know, I think that the NASDAQ should trade down maybe another moving average. So maybe another couple hundred points, and then I'd be more confident buying it again. But like I said, from here, I'm not really interested in buying as much tech. I'd much rather buy some of the other industrial sectors.
Yeah, well, from your lips to God's ears, pal, that's the game we're playing. We've been short.
Amen.
We've been short the NASDAQ. Pretty big position for us, short the NASDAQ for the last 3 weeks. We actually covered today.
Wow, okay.
So got that one right so far. Now, the one caveat I want to throw in there is, since we covered, it's probably a wonderful time to short it.
right? Yeah, right. I hear that.
Fade me.
Yeah.
But anyway, okay. So if the listeners, which I strongly recommend, if they want to get that, the Navigator newsletter daily, they can go to tgmacro.com. They can also follow you on Twitter. Again, strongly recommend it, at tgmacro, right? That's the handle?
Yep.
And again, I appreciate you coming on the show, pal, especially on short notice. I've been wanting to get you on to get your take on things, and then also to issue my apology to say that I was wrong.
Don't apologize. This is trading, man. There's no apologies in trading, Zach. We just put our money down. The dealer takes it when we're wrong, or we put another bet up.
I just, again, man, just tip of the cap. You were dead on the point, and unlike a lot of other people, you know, you pounded the table. So heck of a call, man. And
thank you. You got to remember, you're as good as your last trade. So I just hope I can do it again.
Yeah, there you go. Well, that was a pretty big one, but we appreciate your insights, man. And it's a
awesome
daily input for us. And thanks for coming on, pal. And stay sane.
I will.
Hopefully we can get you back on again.
Oh, I'd love to, man. I'm literally honored that I can be of some value to your operations, Zach. You're such a professional and such an astute student of the market that I have no problem talking with you anytime you want.
Well, thank you, pal. I really appreciate that.
You're very welcome.
Anyway, all right, you guys. Well, hey, we got to run. Wish we'd keep Tony with us all day here, but he's got stuff to do. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week. Got another great interview lined up for you, and we'll see you then. Anyway, appreciate you tuning in. This is Know Your Risk Radio on 97.3 Cairo FM and 770 KTTH. I'm stumbling. Anyway,
awesome.
Have a great weekend. Go Hawks. We'll see you next week.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember, investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.